All right, let's just begin reading in chapter 2, verse 1 again on the third day. Remember, we talked about that. I don't belabor that point. That's not an all-inclusive term. Probably third day from the last day that was mentioned. There was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. We don't know whose wedding it was. Obviously someone that was close to this family. And when they had ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Again, I don't want to belabor that much. We talked about that Sunday morning. This Greek word oinos corresponds with a Hebrew word. And both of those are terms that can refer to both fermented and non-fermented wine. The context has to tell you. Sometimes the context doesn't tell you. But if you determine that, it has to be done by the context. The word itself does not tell us. Jesus replied to her, verse 4, sounds a little abrupt to us, but that's because of a difference in translation. In the original, Jesus wasn't being short or rude to his mother, although it might sound that way to our English-speaking ears. He says, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." And so, to me, the puzzling part of this is, if this is, it says in verse 11, that this is the beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. If we take that in its most literal sense, this is the first miracle that Jesus has ever performed. There was something that led his mother to believe that he could perform a miracle. At least she seemed to be asking for that and expecting that. It doesn't seem to me any indication that she was asking him to leave the festivities and go and get wine in a traditional sense. But she had some kind of inclination that he could do something. And that he does. Verse 6, they were set 6 water pots of stone according to the manner of purification of the Jews. What does that mean, the manner of purification of the Jews? What was this water most likely going to be used for?
Ceremonial washings.
Yeah, maybe the washing. Remember, Jesus' disciples will get in trouble later in his earthly ministry for not washing their hands according to the custom of the Jews. And so it may have been for that in the proceedings. But there's 20 to 30 gallons apiece. So somebody do the math about how much water are we talking about?
180 gallons.
Okay, so about 180 gallons. A lot of water that was here. Jesus said to them, or the pots would have held that much. And Jesus says to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. Maybe the implication is that Jesus had told them to do that, to fill them up to the brim. That may have been a point to prove that this was a miracle and not maybe a normal means of producing wine. Remember in our lesson, our sermon not too long ago, we talked about the idea of drinking of alcohol, talked about the idea of ancient preservation of things, and sometimes they would take the grape juice and boil and render it down basically to a paste, just a very heavy paste, and preserve it that way, and then later on, kind of like what we do with orange juice concentrate. You know, you go to the store and you buy this little can of frozen orange juice concentrate. It's been all the water has been taken, or most of the liquid has been taken out of it, and then you add water, reconstitute it, and bring it back. They would do that with this paste of rendered down grape juice, add it to water, and then make volumes of it that way. Jesus may have been saying, "Fill it up to the rim." To the brim, to show that we're not doing that. We're not adding something to the water. There was no room to dump in this concentrate, we would call it, to produce that. And so it may have been a way to verify that this was truly a miracle in that. But they filled it to the brims, it says. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drew the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom. He said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, And again, don't want to belabor that point. Remember, we said that word doesn't necessarily imply intoxicated. It just means full. It depends on what they were full of, is whether or not they would become intoxicated. But they're well drunk, they're full. Then that which is inferior. But you have kept the good wine until now. That speaks of the quality of this. Jesus didn't just turn water into wine. He turned water into very good wine, very tasty wine. And then it simply says, concludes by saying, the beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested or revealed his glory, revealed who he was. Speaks of maybe to the hesitation of him doing this initially. My time has not yet come. There was a timing involved in all of this. And Jesus, remember, many times early in his ministry, at least, and really throughout his ministry, tried to tamp down the announcement of who he was. How many times did he perform a miracle and tell everybody, or tell the ones involved, now you don't tell anybody what just happened. You keep it to yourself. And there seemed to be a timing issue involved with Jesus and some of these things. And that certainly is the case here. Remember, we said that there are seven miracles that John records explicitly in detail. And this is the first of those seven. And this one describes the power over the quality of a substance. That Jesus can change miraculously one substance into another.
Do you know anything of shedding the light on the statement that Jesus made to his mother that my hour has not yet come? I have a problem with that.
Well, just maybe that it wasn't time for his sonship, his messiahship, to be fully revealed now. That Jesus had a timing issue here of how he wanted to reveal that. And it wasn't going to be just this pow, here I am. It was going to be a slow...
I thought it was unusual for him to say that and then turn around and point a miracle. And I don't really know what he meant by that.
Yeah. Maybe it just the idea of don't rush things. Now, I'll do this, but don't rush things of the performing of miracles and expect that this is going to be all about miracles all the time. It may have been simply it. Yes, he says one kind of reprimands her for that. Not reprimands her, but says that, but then ends up doing it. But simply maybe indicating that this is not what it's all about. And I don't want to make a grand show of this, but we'll do this. All right, there's the beginning of miracles. It says in verse 12, after this he went down to Capernaum, he, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. And they did not stay there many days. And so just the move from Cana of Galilee to Capernaum. And now in verse 13, we've got him moving again. The Passover of the Jews was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem. This brings us to a kind of a reminder of geography as well as particular idioms. Remember that the Greek language and really the Hebrew language, it's different than English, not just that it sounds different and they use different words, but the way they talk was different. Now, you and I are generally map-oriented. And so if we go to Nashville, we go up to Nashville, don't we? If we go to Birmingham, we go down to Birmingham. And if we go to Mississippi or Georgia, we go across or over. And so we speak kind of terms of north, south, east, the way it's oriented on the map. You know, you go up and go down. That's not the way they would have spoken. And they went up to Jerusalem doesn't imply that where they were was south of Jerusalem and they went north to go to Jerusalem. That's the way it sounds to our ears, doesn't it? But that's not the way they would have spoken. They would have spoken in more liberal terms. They went, if you had to go uphill, you went up. If you had to go downhill, you went down. And so think of it in more literal terms. And of course, from just anywhere you would have been, in Palestine, you'd have gone up to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was the highest elevation, and so they would have always gone up to Jerusalem, north, south, east, or west. And so a little bit of geography and idiom there. Another interesting thing in verse 13 is the timing. Jesus' earthly ministry lasted about how long? Okay, in about 3 years, approximately, that doesn't mean to the day, but approximately about 3 years, that can be established in the Gospel of John. Now, John isn't as chronological, remember, as the other Gospel writers, but he does give some indicators here. What event is taking place that causes Jesus to go to Jerusalem? The Passover. John records 4 Passovers. In his gospel. This one here, you'll read about another one in John chapter 5 and verse 1, a third one in John chapter 6 and in verse 4, and the fourth and final one in John chapter 12 and verse 1. Remember, it's that final one, the fourth and final one, that Jesus will be crucified at the time of the Passover. So if we've got, John records 4 Passovers, this one, it's kind of at the beginning of his earthly ministry. And, of course, the last one will be at the end of his time on earth. So if we've got 4 Passovers, if we count years in between those Passover feasts, we have 3 years. And so we can establish the time frame of Jesus' earthly ministry from the Gospel of John, although he's, again, not the most chronological and detailed of them. But we have 4 Passovers, which would have been 3 years in between them. If we count this as the beginning, which it's pretty close. In John's Gospel, not much has happened prior to that. And then we have established that 3-year time frame. And so he goes up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple, verse 14 says, those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business. Now, a couple of things here. First of all, in the temple doesn't mean they were in the most holy place or even in the holy place. There was an outer court to the temple, and sometimes the term temple referred to the entire temple complex. And so when he says in the temple, don't think they were there by the table of showbread doing this, but they were in the temple compound selling oxen and sheep and doves. Why would they have been selling these animals in around the temple? Okay, for sacrifices. Remember, by this time, the Jew, what we sometimes call the dispersion or the diaspora had happened, and these Jews are scattered all over the world. Remember, not many years after this, the Apostle Paul goes on his missionary journey, and he finds synagogues all over the Roman world. And these Jews have scattered, and it became kind of impractical. These Jews had to all come home for the Passover feast and offer these sacrifices. It wasn't practical to bring your oxen with you from Rome to Jerusalem. You know, put that in your carry-on baggage and bring that with you. And so this practice had arisen to assist them, that you would just go there and buy whatever sacrifice was required of you and your family. You would buy it there and offer that sacrifice. And so that's what these merchandisers were doing there. The money changers, it may seem like an obvious question, but what were the money changers there for?
Changing money for whatever they needed for the pay for the sacrifice.
Okay, to change their money maybe from larger bills into smaller bills, some of that was being done. Ed?
Well, the Roman, from what I understand, the Roman government would not allow the Jews to mint their own money. But they required to pay the temple tax and funds that did not have an image on the money. And so they would use Tyrian money, and that would be exchanged within the temple precinct itself.
Yeah. The Jews considered that money to have a graven image on it. It had a picture of Caesar on it, and they wouldn't pay their tax with that Roman money. Not just because it was Roman, there may have been some objection to that, but because it had an image of the Caesar on it, and so they would exchange it for this other, in which they could pay their temple tax with that. And again, that was just there to necessitate or to facilitate that transaction.
Well, we conclude from this that they became less agrarian, because, you know, it's specified many times you get through vestments law and that sort of thing. Just wonder how do we get around that aspect out of it?
You know, there may have been some objectionable parts to this, that it wasn't, you know, kind of like maybe not to the low degree of Malachi's day. Remember, Malachi's day, they're bringing their sick and the lame and something they just found dead in a ditch somewhere. Maybe not to that extent, but you're right. It kind of, at first glance, doesn't strike you to be the straight fulfillment of the best of your flock and doing those things. And so there may be some objection to that as well. But Jesus finds these, we've got really two different classes of men there, those who sold and those who were money changing, doing business. Literally, it was, it says, sitting there. And verse 15 says, when he had made a whip out of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. What a spectacle that, wouldn't you love to have seen that? You know, here these grown men in here setting up shop, and I don't know exactly what it looked like, but they had tables or maybe like kind of booths. I picture it set up with the different things going on. And here comes Jesus in here with this whip that he's made, and he's just running them out of there and drives them out of there and turns over the tables of the things that they have done. And then makes this bold declaration that we're going to see. Mark?
That was one of my questions. Is, if you got a shop set up just buying and selling of that nature, he requires the very best, the first to sacrifice to God. And that couldn't possibly have taken place if you're just buying something to give to the Lord and sacrifice.
Yeah. Were every one of these sheep that were there for sale, were they all the best of the flock? Were they all of a year old, unblemished? And yeah, I think we could probably see a lot of objectionable things if we look at this in the layers of it. Yeah.
They were just there to make money.
Yeah. Yeah, most likely. And I think that's going to be in strongly implied in what Jesus' statement is. Okay. Ed?
But there's one thing that's not objectionable. But what they were doing was not illegal and was not unlawful. That they were performing service.
Yeah.
But it was a place where it was being done.
Yeah. And maybe some of the shortcuts that were being taken. The act itself maybe wasn't objectionable, but we can see that some of these may be shortcuts to the law might have been taken, and we're not sure. And he said to those who sold the doves, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. Is this the only time that Jesus does such a thing? In Matthew chapter 21 tells us, turn over there real quickly. I told you when we started the study of the book of John, we weren't going to do a whole lot of looking at the other gospels, but I want to make a contrast here. This is again at the beginning of his ministry in John. Matthew says he does it again at the end of his ministry in Matthew 21. These are not the same event. And I don't see any way that we can reconcile these two stories as being the same time. It appears to me that all evidence is that these, obviously, that these are two separate occasions. And it says in Matthew chapter 21, verse 12, Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. Now his statement is different here, isn't it? He says, you've made it what in Matthew's account? A den of thieves. John's account says you've made it what?
House of merchandise.
A house of merchandise. Those are two different things there. But again, these are two different events that take place. In Matthew's account, he seems to be accusing them of the crooked practices. Maybe as Barker said, maybe that you're not bringing the best of the flock. You know, you're bringing just whatever you can sell, and you're just making money on this. We have a term for this in our day, in our economy, that maybe what they were doing in Matthew's account is price gouging. You know, you're a good, religious, observant Jew. You need an oxen. You need a sheep. You need a dove. Well, that guy selling knows that, doesn't he? And so he's going to jack up the prices, you know, kind of like trying to buy a generator after a tornado. They know you need one, and so they can gouge the prices, and so that's most likely what was being done in Matthew's account. But in John's earlier account, he doesn't accuse them of being thieves necessarily. That may have been going on, and that may have been some of the problem, but that's not the language he uses in John chapter 2, verse 16. He says, a house of merchandise. The Greek word for this is a Greek word that you know. You don't know you know it, but this word, the Greek word is emporium. And we get our English word emporium from that. And I think that sheds light on this. It doesn't seem to me that Jesus is necessarily condemning this service that was offered. But he says, you've turned my Father's house into a house of merchandise. You've turned it into an emporium. That's all it's become to you. You're not offering this as a service for these observant Jews who couldn't bring an ox all the way from their homeland to here. And you're not just offering a service. And you can kind of see where it happens that way. It probably started out that way. I don't know what year this first started when they started setting up tables and selling these kind of things. But you can see it maybe started out sincerely. And as a servant, look, these Jews, they get here, they need something to offer, and so let's fix it where they can have something to offer. But it probably didn't take it too long before somebody said, I think we can make a business out of this rather than just a service out of this. We can make a business out of this. And then somebody else sees that and thinks, well, why is old brother so-and-so the only one getting rich? I'm going to raise up a crop of doves, and I'll be here next year. And you can almost just imagine how it evolved or devolved into this situation to where all it was for them was a flea market, we would say. You've turned the temple of God into a flea market. You're not just offering a service so people can worship God. You're here for the money. Mike?
Well, I was thinking about two things. I thought that maybe the Pharisees and the when the sacrifice and all sort of first started, that they took one from their own flock when they had raised the best. So now they're in the temple, they just buy what's available. So
maybe cheapening the whole process. Yeah, may have been a part of this.
Standards are dropping a little.
Right. And there's always somebody going to take advantage of that. And that's what happens here. But then Luke adds this, then his disciples in verse 17 remembered that it was written, he quotes from the Psalm, zeal for your house has eaten me up, or has consumed me from this. So the Jews answered and said to him, what sign do you show to us since you do these things? How would we have worded that, or not necessarily we, but how would people have worded that question today, that statement?
Whose authority are you? Where'd you get the authority to do this?
Yeah. Who are you to do this? Who gave you the authority that you can just come in here? You know, the chief priest and the elders obviously don't have any objection to this. The high priest hasn't put a stop to it. These men in positions of authority. Who are you? Who gives you the, what gives you the authority to come in and be the boss, in essence? And Jesus said to them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then the Jew says, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But John adds, and of course John has the benefit of hindsight when he's writing this down, but he was speaking of the temple of his body. That's the sign that will be given. It's interesting to note that of the numerous miracles that Jesus performed, that when asked, what sign will you give? This isn't the only time Jesus will be asked this question. What sign will be given? Jesus doesn't point back to Cana of Galilee, turning water into wine. When he's asked this question later, he doesn't point back to the healing of a leper or the opening of the eyes of a blind man or even the raising of Lazarus. He always says the resurrection. That's the sign that will be given. Now, that's not to diminish the miracles that he performed. But they were not the sign. They were signs. That's the primary word that John uses of miracles, is the word signs. So they were signs. But when Jesus is asked here, what sign will you give? Jesus doesn't point back to the turning water to wine. He doesn't perform another miracle. He could have at that point. But he holds out that the resurrection from the grave is the sign that would be the proof of his authority. And obviously the Jews of that day, as well as his apostles, didn't understand the statement that he was making at that moment. But John tells us in verse 22, when they did figure it out, therefore, when he had risen from the dead, 3 years later, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. Wouldn't you have loved to have been a part of that conversation? You know, I don't know. When I read that, I don't know. I understand it's not necessarily implied. When I read verse 22, it reads to me like this was kind of a group revelation, that they were together when they figured that out. Again, I'm not saying that necessarily implied. But wouldn't you love to be a part of that conversation? When they were talking about the resurrection of the dead, they were discussing these things. And maybe somebody says, do you remember when Jesus said, destroy this temple and I'll build it again in 3 days? As they started connecting those dots, I'd love to have been a part of that revelation conversation. Ed?
I think there are a couple of things that are interesting in this section. Number one, John never uses the word power in his book. They're always signs.
Signs.
And the Old Testament is just beneath the surface, because these incidences would remind the disciples, zeal for your house will consume you, from Psalm 69. The second thing is that they obviously believe that Jesus was some type of a prophet. And so they're going to ask him, what are your signs? We want to check you out. And if your signs come true, then we're going to know that you're a true prophet.
Mm-hmm.
So it appears to me that there is some legitimacy in what they're asking for a sign. They're not just curious.
Yeah.
They want him to prove what his identity is.
His bona fides, if he's going to be acting in such a position of authority. He needs proof of that. And you're right. And we'll hit that as we go through so much of the Old Testament undertones here. In what's taking place. Maybe you have to be careful in maybe connecting dots that aren't there sometimes. The turning water into wine. Does that remind you of some Old Testament sign that Moses performed?
They turned the water into blood.
I don't know. Again, John doesn't draw a dot, connect a dot to that. But the possibility that there's some kind of undertone. Yes, being in the belly of the fish is another sign that he says will be given. And again, a reference there to his resurrection. Always veiled references to his resurrection, though.
And there's one other point, and that is that there's sort of a time signature here, because 46 years this temple has been building, and Herod started building the temple somewhere around 20 B.C.
Yeah.
And it would be another 20 years before it would be completed.
Yeah, this long. Right? We have the temple, of course, originally built by Solomon, rebuilt in the times of Zechariah and Haggai, and then Herod began a remodeling, an extensive remodeling and rebuilding of it. You're right, the 46 years there gives us a time stamp as to when we're at in the grand calendar of time. Now, when he was in Jerusalem, verse 23, at the Passover, during the feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. Now, this reminds us of how John's going to end his book, isn't it? Many other signs did Jesus that are not written in this book. Well, here are some of them. I think we would include these, although he mentions signs. I think this would be in the group, some that John doesn't really mention. He doesn't tell us what signs these were.
Right after he went in and drove out the people out of the temple, I think he was a reference to people coming to him to be healed. And he started healing them, I probably read that a few years ago.
Yes, the many different healings, and this would draw, you know, it gained attention, and people began coming to him. But this goes kind of to what he'd said to his mother at the beginning of signs in verse 24, but Jesus did not commit himself to them because he knew all men and had no need that anyone should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. He did not commit himself to them. You might have a translation that words that differently at the beginning of verse 24.
Entrust.
Did not entrust himself to them. Really, the idea of trust. You know, he didn't trust them because he knew what was in man. And so, is the implication there that some of these people were believing in him, following him, just because of the signs, not as the signs of proof of who he was, but simply maybe out of selfish motives in this. But Jesus did not fully trust some of these believers. He knew, in other words, he could know the heart of man. Now in chapter 3, we're introduced to a famous event, famous person, an event in the life of Christ. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. Hopefully we've talked enough about the different sects of the Jews to know who we're talking about when we say the Pharisees. This man Nicodemus was a Pharisee, not just a Pharisee, but a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, you'll read a whole lot about Nicodemus coming to him by night. I don't know that we need to make anything of that other than that's when he came. Some people will say, well, he was a coward. He wouldn't come in the daytime. He came at night. That's reading a whole lot into the text. That may be the case, but if I come to see you at night, it doesn't mean I'm a coward. I don't want to be seeing you in the daytime. It just means that's when I came to see you. So be careful be reading too much into the timing of this. Matt?
Maybe he wanted some personal time. He knew in the daytime he was seeing lots of people, and he wanted a personal conversation with him. So,
yeah, this is more of a quiet time. And I've got an important question, and all these people mobbing around him, he's not going to be able to answer. Yeah, that to me would be the most reasonable explanation. But he came to Jesus and said to him, "Rabbi." And what's the word "rabbi" mean?
Teacher.
Just teacher. Don't take this as some kind of formal title. Just the idea of teacher or wise one. We know that you're a teacher come from God. For no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. And so this references back again to verse 23 of chapter 2, the signs that Jesus did and the effect that these signs had. We've talked about this again at some length in other settings, that was, of course, the purpose of these signs and miracles, was to convince that exactly this, God is with him. And that wasn't an end of itself. That was a means to verify the message that was spoken. That was the end result.
Would this indicate, too, that this is not the first encounter that Nicodemus had had with Jesus? He had witnessed some of these things?
Yeah. He had some encounters with him, if just as a bystander, just watching some of these things. And Jesus answered and said to him, most assuredly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Now, first glance when you read that, you think, now where did that come from? That, you know, Nicodemus has just simply said, you're a man from God. And Jesus says, unless one be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Again, make reference back to the idea that Jesus knew the hearts of men. He may have known that this was a question on Nicodemus' mind. Unless one is born again. Do you have a translation that says that a little differently? Born again is what the New King James says.
In the ESV says the same thing.
Okay.
A new,
born anew. I know some translations have that. Both of those, born again, born anew, are hinting that he's talking about a different type of birth. than the one that might immediately come to mind. And Nicodemus has some questions about this. He says in verse 4, how can a man be born when he's old? How can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? I don't think Nicodemus is really thinking that's what Jesus meant. I think he's just saying, I don't understand what you mean. This is what birth means this. And so you're not saying that, are you? So what are you saying? What kind of birth are you talking about, Jesus?
There also may be, on Nicodemus' part, I'm an old man, and I'm too old to change. I'm too old to undergo this
transformation. Yeah. Maybe so. I never thought about it that way.
I really think that he is not a dumb man. Right. Jesus is called the teacher of the Jews, which evidently means he is a preeminent teacher.
Yeah.
He's not a dunce.
Yeah. So he may have been making some kind of moral lesson in there. But Jesus gets to the point in verse 5, most assuredly I say to you, unless one is born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. Of course, the question of the hour is, what does it mean to be born of the water and the Spirit? And we really need to break that question down to look at it. First of all, is that two different births that Jesus is talking about? Is he saying two births? One birth is being born of water, and the second birth is being born of the Spirit. Some interpret that to mean that what the first birth, the born of the water, is the physical birth. And the argument would go this way, that either the water means one of two things. One is, it could mean, the most obvious thing is, that there's water associated with the physical birth of a baby, isn't there? We all know that. That's one of the signs that the baby's coming. The water's broken. And so there's water, liquid involved with that physical birth. And so Jesus is saying, you got to be born physically, born of water, and then born spiritually, born of the Spirit. Another possible interpretation, and I'll try to be as delicate as I can here, but the Jews apparently sometimes used the idea of the language of water to speak of the seed of man that would bring about conception was sometimes referred to as water. And so maybe that's the conception concept is being talked about there. I don't think that's what John is saying. I think born of the water and the Spirit are one birth. I don't think he's saying that you have to be born physically and born spiritually. I think the evidence for that is maybe threefold. Number one is that the physical birth is given. Why does he mention you have to be born physically and born spiritually when everybody's born physically? And so why mention that with such emphasis when it's a given? But look at this. Look in verse 6. When Jesus talks about fleshly birth, what expression does he use in verse 6? That which is born of the flesh. He doesn't say that which is born of the water. And so, to me, with John's expression for the physical birth is born of the flesh, not born of the water. And so, that's one evidence. We'll look at some more. I think there's some other passages in the New Testament that are reminiscent of this passage, but we're running out of time. And so, we'll pick up there. John 3, verse 5, next time.